All right.
You got me?
I got you. Jeff?
Sonny.
You here?
I'm here.
So this, our next guest, who's our next guest?
Janice Lee.
Janice, I got to turn you up. You're a little soft. There we go. Janice is, I think, the first person we're talking to that neither of us know.
Never met her before in my entire life.
But you do have some connection to her.
I think she was an editor at this website, HTML Giant, which I infrequently contributed to. So I went through my electronic mail, and I think we had a correspondence starting in 2011. And then she does a website now called Entropy, which is really great. And then she also is, I don't know if she's the publisher, main editor, one of the main editors at a press called Civil Coping Mechanisms that does a lot of cool books. And I know some of the people she's published, but I've never actually met her. And I've also read her book, The Sky Isn't Blue. I think it's her latest collection.
Cool. So everyone can get to know her as we do.
I guess that's the goal.
Okay. Here we go.
Janice Lee.
Welcome to the steer.
Is that good? Is that
yeah, that's good. Intro? That's nice. Really kind of like
a good intonation.
Well, I don't mean on the air, but I just mean in general because, well, whatever. Yeah.
Do you want to be back there?
No, I can lean. I was just kind of just like relaxing before we.
Well, sometimes relaxing is.
Yeah, we don't. It's
just
pretty.
Just sit where you want, and I'll move the mic to you.
Okay, this is probably fine.
Yeah.
Are you working? You're working on a book right now too.
I am.
How's it going?
Okay. Yeah. Are we recording right now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean, like I said, I don't know where it'll actually start, but we're recording. I'm also messing with levels.
Is it going well? Do you not want to talk about it?
The book?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm working on a novel right now, and it was slow going for a while. I had a sort of strange period of writer's block.
10 months in this, or is that a different thing?
It's a different writer's block. That was a project that also came out of a different writer's block. Block's a strange kind of category of thing, I guess. But this is a novel and it's very different. It requires a lot of like emotional kind of sitting with things in order to write it.
Mm-hmm.
So partially what I've been doing to sort of connect it with the music is I've been listening to very certain music as I've been writing it. So when I'm actually working on the novel, all I listen to is Russian Circles or Godspeed You Black Emperor just on repeat. And there's something about the intensity of the kind of instrumental music that actually helps me focus.
Right.
Yeah, the book is they're very long sentences, and they're kind of things that are going in and out of objects and things and consciousnesses. So it doesn't really stop. So the music not stopping actually helps because they're very long songs. And
right. So now do you, for each book that you work on, do you listen to music? I guess for The Sky Isn't Blue, did you listen to certain music, or does that just depend?
It sort of just depends. I mean, in the past, you know, I've listened to music sometimes on and off. The Sky Isn't Blue, I was watching a lot of Nashville, and so a lot of that music is sort of part of it, sort of the pop culture references.
Mm-hmm.
But for this book, it's been very intentional. It started with listening to Russian Circles while I was writing, and there was some relationship that was established, so I just kind of continued it.
And how would you describe Russian Circles for people who don't know that I'm in?
It's so I guess like officially it's considered maybe like a post rock, post metal genre type of music, but it's all instrumental. It's, you know, has sort of like the kind of rock metal feel, but I really like it because it doesn't have the vocals, right? I have a lot of friends who love metal, and I love the kind of classical composition styles of a lot of those songs, minus the vocals, which is very contentious of a lot of my friends who really appreciate that. But the songs are very long. They have these kind of epic narratives that kind of fade in and fade out.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some kind of feeling with like the headphones on and just sitting and writing. There's kind of like this ebb and flow that kind of the music creates in terms of how I'm writing.
And the sentences in this forthcoming book, they're long. Yeah. So it goes with the long songs, kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, and it's not like an exact start and stop with the songs.
Right,
but
well, no, yeah.
Because there aren't lyrics and because there aren't stopping points, there's like a fluidity that I can kind of just stay with one thought for a prolonged period of time.
Uh-huh. You were born at one point?
I was, I believe.
So then what did your parents do? Where, what's your familial background?
So my parents are from Korea. Okay. My mom was from South Korea and my dad was born in North Korea but moved to South Korea at a young age.
At a young age, you said?
Yeah, I think he was like four, right okay. after. He was very young. Mm-hmm. And this was his a child right around the time of the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
And they came here before I was born. And so I was born in San Francisco. My dad has worked various jobs throughout his life.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from being, you know, running a photo development place to working on an assembly line to repairing shoes, working at a gas station. He's retired now.
All in the Bay, though. This was all in the Bay.
This was mostly in the Bay and also Stockton.
Okay.
Which I guess is still kind of the general area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then my mom was a waitress for much of her life. The last thing that she did was to run the gas station with my dad before she passed away.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the gas station, he ran a gas station.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then writing, music, entertainment in general, is it part of your life growing up?
Yeah.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a sister.
Okay.
Yeah. My sister's really into music. A lot of my musical tastes have changed and fluctuated throughout the years because she's so into different genres. So, you know, I would often be listening to sort of whatever my friends were listening to. And then she would introduce me to some, you know, band. She'd be listening to something and be like, what is that?
She's older?
She's younger. Oh, she's younger. But okay. She's actually kind of opened up a lot more of what I listen to.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, growing up, my mom loved Michael Jackson. She mm-hmm. loved Elvis Presley. Elvis Presley's still really emotional for me to listen to. So sometimes I'll listen to it in the car, like on her birthday or something. But she loved it a lot. She would have dreams about him and my dad would get jealous.
She would tell at like the breakfast table? She would tell
at the breakfast table, yeah. She'd be like, I had a dream that I was at one of his concerts and Elvis touched my hand. And I have a feeling that the dreams were probably more detailed than that, and that's all she could tell her kids, right?
Oh, really?
You know, I don't know. I mean,
Sure.
You know, she wasn't that much of a like, you know, but yeah, it's just funny. She'd be really excited and my dad would be jealous. In sort of like a playful way.
Right. Well, I don't know what Freud would say, but it's a dream. I mean.
How long did you live in San Francisco?
Barely. Actually, I was born in San Francisco, but we lived in Oakland, and then Fairfield, Sacramento, Cupertino.
Mm-hmm.
It's all California.
Was this your childhood? You moved that much?
This is my childhood. We moved all the time. Yeah. And then Cupertino is where I went to high school. So I stayed there the longest.
Was it for your parents' work that you kept moving?
It was, yeah, wherever they could find work. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Because they didn't have really stable careers. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was it tough moving around?
You know, I didn't really think that much of it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I think because I got to do junior high and high school in one place.
So
that kind of felt pretty continuous. I feel like if I had to move in the middle of high school, that probably would have been more devastating. But mm-hmm. as a kid, I think it was just like part of life.
Yeah. I got moved around a lot during elementary school and I remember it. Every new year was confusing because you walk into this classroom and every face looks so weird.
Yeah.
You're like, who the heck are these kids?
Yeah. It's easier as a kid, though, you know, because like if you're like in second grade, like, you know, you just make a friend the first day. You just like sit next to someone and you're just like, hey, do you want to be my friend? You can't do that when you're 16. You know, there's all of these politics around everything.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
When you're older, that's definitely true.
It gets harder and harder, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think as you get old, I just moved back here. I was in Omaha for 2 years teaching and I was very isolated there because
now that you're old too, or that I'm old, it's hard to break into communities. I mean, and I guess you first get the inkling of that in high school, right? Or maybe junior high. How would you classify yourself?
In terms of?
Well, I don't know. Were you, like, I was a skater / kind of derelict. Were you, like,
a punk?
Is that your official label for yourself?
Person? No, it wasn't I didn't wear, like, a t-shirt with that. But, I mean, what was your crowd, I guess?
Yeah, in high school was sort of strange because I went to a strange high school. So it was in Cupertino, and the school's very academic. So this was a type of school where, I think we had like 16 students in my graduating class go to Stanford.
Oh, damn.
You know, they were like, I don't remember how many valedictorians there were, but they were that many people with perfect GPAs.
Gosh. This was a public school or
this
private?
This was a public school.
But it was high achieving.
But it was very high achieving. And so it wasn't sort of the traditional thing where the kind of sports teams and the jocks were the popular kids. Actually, a lot of the time, academically high achieving students, would be like the ASB president of the class or something like that. So it was a very sort of different type of hierarchy. I studied hard. I wasn't the hardest studying kid, but I did study hard. My parents kind of made sure of that. But I roamed around a lot. So I had friends that I knew growing up, and they were my close friends that, you know, I had sort of since I had moved there, and we'd play video games and things like that together. But then I also had friends that I would go to the mall with and go to parties with. And then I had different friends that, you know, were like the art kids, and we would talk about art. So I was sort of a floater. I didn't have like one kind of circle. I think that was pretty common at my school in general.
And you were happy as a floater. You didn't want a solidified group, really.
I mean, I don't know. It's hard to describe like any period of high school as being happy.
Oh, so was it bad for you?
I don't know if anyone looks back at high school being like, oh, those were good years.
What about you? Do you look back at high school as good or bad? Sunny.
Bad.
Bad, really?
Oh my God, it was horrible.
Really?
Oh, I hate it.
I don't look back at it as that bad.
I know. Talking to you, I've gotten the feeling that you enjoyed.
What does that mean? That I wear my high school. I just didn't. Are you being serious? You think that when you talk to me, what comes out is this guy is fine with his high school experience?
Yeah. Like the moment I met you, I was like, oh, good high school.
And then you're like, what a tool.
I started judging you. No, that's not true. No, you've mentioned various stories about high school, and it sounded like you were getting in trouble but enjoying it. Isn't that accurate?
I wasn't really getting... I got arrested once.
Yeah. That's trouble.
That's not really trouble. That was an isolated incident.
It sounds like you were happy and maybe felt kind of free.
I came on the cusp of when, like, skateboarding and snowboarding, those things were getting cool. So I was, like, right... Because there was a divide between the... We'll just use the stereotypical 80s terminology. There was a divide between, like... Before me, there was a divide between jocks and kind of like weirdos or like people like skate. And then I kind of came into it when some of the jocks were like, oh, we should try snowboarding. It seems like that's a popular thing. So we were not like the cool kids, but we also weren't outcasts, essentially. Mm-hmm. We were sometimes invited to parties. I went to a party before.
But I just get the impression that you weren't sort of ground down emotionally by whatever pressure, peer pressure.
Well, I mean, I was extraordinarily insecure. But I guess I could kind of mask that insecurity within a bigger group of people.
Yeah.
But I guess that's a lot of people's high school experiences, right?
I don't know. Janice?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think I had those same insecurities and all of that, but I think there were so many different pressures that I felt like I was handling, so...
From your parents?
From all over.
From all over.
Because it was such a high-achieving school, mm-hmm. right, everyone was feeling that pressure. So this is a school where, lots of students had difficult relationships with their parents if their grades weren't good enough. It was, intense and, pressures. were really high and mounting. So there were pressures all the time put on by parents, teachers, other students, right? Yourself. And in the end, it's always yourself. That's kind of the hardest, right? But then there's also the regular pressures of being a teenager in high school and dating and boys. And I was terrified of my mother because, you know, she didn't want me to date boys. And every time it was like this kind of, you know, horrifying trying to game of like hide and seek. I think all of that. We also had a lot of kind of financial things because my parents wanted me to be in the school district that I was in, and we kind of lived on the border of the district in order for me to be able to go to the better school. It also sort of meant that I was often working a part-time job to sort of help out. Yeah.
That's what I was wondering. If when you said that so many of the kids were so academically focused, so it was a pretty affluent.
Yes.
Okay.
Was it a big school?
Yes. Most people's parents were engineers and doctors, middle class, upper middle class. I didn't know it at the time, and I just thought this was normal. But looking back on it, it's a pretty, you know, Cupertino, a lot of Silicon Valley is pretty, you know, middle class. And most of my friends that I went to of high school have gone on to be engineers or doctors. Mm.
Was it mostly white?
No, it was actually a lot of Asian American students because of the location in Silicon Valley. There was a lot of kind of Chinese Americans and
part-time jobs.
I worked at the mall, so sometimes I would tutor, but for the job that I remember, well, I worked at well, I can't remember. I worked at Mervyn's for a little bit.
Oh, gosh.
I think it was Mervyn's. And then I worked at Forever 21 for a while at the mall.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Now, are you writing at this time? Are you watching films? Are you playing video games? Are you listening to music? Are some of these experiences kind of...
No, I would not know that I would be a writer until much later. I was supposed to be on the track to be a doctor.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I was, you know... working and then figuring out when to do my calculus homework and my biology AP homework. And I always loved my English classes. They were always my favorite, but it was never a thing that, oh, I was going to be a writer. I never didn't really think that.
Right. And then so you graduate, and then what happens?
I graduated. I went to UC San Diego with a major in biology. And at the time, I think I kind of kept a fantasy in the back of my head that I would somehow figure out a way to either double major or... you know, be a doctor and write in my spare time, right? I didn't really know what people's schedules were really like as adults. So I took a lot of writing classes, and I eventually ended up dropping the biology and just majoring in literature and writing. And then I also studied film and anthropology.
Did you like biology, or was it just something that you felt
like
you had to
do? I did. I liked the subject matter, but the classes were very... how would I put it? I mean, I remember having to take like OChem, organic chemistry, is a class that everyone dreads, right, as a science major. And it's like a lecture hall of like 200 or 300 students. The teacher doesn't speak very good English because he's there as a researcher. It's a research university, right? So he's not there to teach. He's there to teach as part of his contract, but he really wants to research. So you don't really understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember sitting there and just like, all of these students in this lecture hall want to be doctors, and they all want to go to med school, and they will tear each other to shreds to do it because they tell you at the very beginning, they're like, you know, only half of you are going to finish this major. Only half of that will like end up getting the requirements to apply to medical school. And then only like a half of that will, you know, anywhere. They tell you that from the beginning in order to motivate you to work hard, right? It's not really a great positive motivational speech.
Were you cognizant of all the competition that it seemed like you were kind of immersed in?
Yes, but I think because I grew up in it, it didn't seem so strange. Right? It was very gradual realizing that this is not the way that things should be.
Sure. And do you, going back to music, I mean, are there songs now that you think of or albums or musicians that you listen to in college or high school that... you think of now with distaste, or you remember listening to, or like anti-nostalgia? Or was that was so out of, wasn't something you were doing?
Yeah, I don't really. I don't really remember anything in particular. Yeah, I don't know.
I'll be right back.
So then was it a big decision when you told your parents essentially that you were switching? I mean, were they still, what is your, how young is your sister, or how?
My sister is 2 years younger than me.
Okay. So you were in high school at the same time and she was.
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we knew each other, you know,
but we wouldn't
talk to each other at school.
That's
right?
Really?
Because of, you know, sibling kind of things. But we were fine. There wasn't like any rivalry or anything like that.
But you wouldn't even acknowledge one another.
No, I mean, we would acknowledge each other, but we wouldn't hang out or anything. It was also a very big high school, so we wouldn't see each other that often.
Okay, so.
Yeah. But when I told my parents they wasn't going to do the bio and that I wanted to be a writer, it was definitely a conversation. And I remember my dad was just sort of very silent in the back, which is often scarier, right, the silence.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was sort of freaking out, and it's interesting. I mean, she is the one that most influenced my love of literature. She would read to me as a child. She loved books, and she would read a lot when she was in Korea and when she was young. And she was very artistic. So she instilled a lot of that in us, but she also had very like practical dreams for us and wanted, you know, she was worried about us and how we would be. And she,
sure.
almost all the problems that she felt like she had to do with money. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think she thought that would solve, you know, all of her children's problems. So she was mostly freaked out. But, you know, they didn't have anything to hold against me. They weren't paying for anything. We were poor. So everything that was paying for college was either financial aid or loans. So they didn't have any.
They couldn't really. They
didn't have any power over that. Yeah. And eventually my mom was very supportive. And she was alive for when my first book was published.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that she, you know, could see like a concrete thing that came out of it and I think that made her feel better.
Sure. And then do you remember what she would read to you, or just the general act of reading?
All sorts of things. The one I remember most is I had this, it was like a treasury kind of anthology of different fairy tales and things, but it also had like excerpts from books like Narnia, and I still actually have it. It's totally torn up and there's drawings everywhere, but she would read different things from that to me.
Did you see the TV show Grimm?
I saw part of it. Yeah, okay. I do remember. Yeah.
It was set in Portland.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't watch a lot of television programs, but that one's good.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember liking it, but I didn't finish it.
No, it's not really that good a show, but
it was fun. I mean,
it holds a fond place in my heart. So when did you tell them that you wanted to change majors?
You know, I forget what year it was, but it was at some point where I wouldn't have been too late. So I'm imagining maybe like my second or third year in college. And part of it was I'd already been taking a lot of writing classes, and the plan had been to get enough credits to be able to declare a double major.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened actually was I was sort of already doing really horribly in my OChem class at the time, just for various reasons. And it wasn't really like me because I sort of always had that pressure, so I was always an A student, and so it was really hard for me to not do well in a class.
In high school, you always got A's. I mean,
Yeah.
Okay, so you might have had trials and tribulations, but you still always did well in school.
I did, because there was so much pressure. I mean, I had, you know, my mother was the kind of mother when if I brought home a test and I got like a 98, you know, the question would be, why didn't I get 100? So it was a lot of pressure. It was a lot of stress.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a lot of hard work in order to be able to sort of maintain that. And in college, there were lots of other things that were also happening. So it was sort of more difficult and, you know, different the ways that things were structured. But at around the time where I would be studying for my OChem final, I was in the spring, a friend of mine from high school committed suicide in New York.
Okay.
She jumped off, I don't remember which building, but one of the buildings at NYU.
Close friend.
Not like a super close friend, but a friend that I had, you know, that I would definitely have called a friend and, you know, hung out with.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty devastating.
This is your sophomore or junior year?
This was either my sophomore or junior year. I can't remember which.
Mm-hmm.
And her funeral was scheduled around the same time as my final would have been.
In OChem.
In OChem, yeah. And her funeral was scheduled in, you know, back in the Bay Area. And I kind of, you know, and it turned into this, like, decision. Did I want to go to her funeral and attend the service, or did I want to stay and take my OChem final? And that actually sort of made it really easy because I had a reason to not take the final. So I failed the class. It was too late to drop the class. So I have an F on my transcript.
Oh, God. That's the scarlet letter.
Yeah, so I didn't take the final. I just completely missed it. I, you know, took the F. Mm-hmm. You know, and I went to the service, and I think that was one of the first times in my life that sort of made me have to prioritize, but it also actually forced me to just really realize what it was that I actually wanted to do.
Sure.
And for much of my life, it had been trying to do what I thought other people wanted me to do.
So kind of failure is breakthrough.
Yeah, yeah.
And then did you switch soon after to writing literature?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. UC San Diego. Do you know Flynn Ginty?
No.
Okay. He went to UC San Diego. He's a chum of mine. So you graduate, and then what happens?
I went to grad school at CalArts, and I got my MFA there.
Right. Did you go right after?
Mm-hmm.
And then what are you, I guess, listening and watching at this point? I mean, are you influenced only by, what are you doing outside of school?
I was watching a lot of film. I had picked up a minor in film studies, so I was watching a lot of film, and a lot of my friends at the time were film students.
Mm-hmm.
So I also helped work on a lot of, you know, student film productions and things. So I was watching all sorts of films and discovering, you know, all of the great classic films and foreign films, and kind of watching as many of them as I could.
Did you think about being a screenwriter? Did you think about that? No, was a minor.
Never.
Why
never.
Not?
Screenwriting is so different from other types of writing. I hated it.
You tried.
I tried to do it, and I tried to help friends, and I find the format so restrictive.
Uh-huh.
And I love films, and I love watching them, but the aspects of films that interest me the most are not the story, are not the dialogue, are not the screenplays.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't anything that I was interested in. Yeah.
What part of films, what are the aspects that you like?
I watch films very conceptually, so things like the story and like that definitely matter, but I am often paying attention to like the relationship between the lighting and the music and the shots. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily like breaking them down on a technical level. I mean, I did that in school also, but sort of how all of that comes together.
I could imagine knowing that if someone had you list all your favorite films, it could be a really seemingly unrelated array because of what you're looking at. They might think, well, that's a good story and that's a bad story. Why does she like both? And it's because they both have a certain look or something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, my film taste really vary. So on one end of the regular spectrum, I really love the whole Fast and Furious series, right?
Yeah.
For very, very different reasons than I would like other films, right? They're not good films. They're very problematic, but I love them and, you know, I'm entertained by them and, you know. But on the other end, probably my favorite filmmaker at the time is Bélatar, who's a Hungarian filmmaker.
Mm-hmm. Who I know nothing about. Do you know anything about Bélatar? Can you give us a brief synopsis?
Yeah, so he is a Hungarian filmmaker, and you know, he's known for making these kind of long black and white films. He's known for having very long shots, right?
Okay.
Minutes can go by without anything, without a cut. He's often compared to Tarkovsky.
Okay.
For, you know, having sort of similar kind of subject matter and similar kind of aesthetics, I think they're actually very different, right? And Bélatar once actually in an interview responded like to that comparison. He's like, well, you know, in Tarkovsky films, when you see rain purifies. It's like poetry. It purifies. And in my films, they just make mud. His films are a lot bleaker, right?
Bélatar or Tarkovsky?
Bélatar.
Okay.
Yeah. Tarkovsky films to me, I mean, I also love Tarkovsky, but they do seem a lot more, there's a lot more kind of poetry, and he's doing a lot more to bring things out with lighting, right? He wants to sort of bring poetry out in his subjects. And I think Bélatar is doing a lot more where it feels like he's trying to kind of show you more kind of grittier things about something that's already there. And he's most of his many of his screenplays, he's collaborated with the Hungarian writer László Krasznahorkai.
Okay.
He won a Man Booker couple of years ago. And so a lot of his films have been collaborations or based on his books. Yeah.
Is Belatar from the same time period as Tarkovsky?
Belatar is a little bit more recent, I would say. Yeah. I mean, he's still he recently retired. He says that he made his last film.
Were you bummed about that?
He's teaching now. He's at a film school in Budapest, I believe. Yeah, so Belatar's a little bit more contemporary. Yeah.
Do you believe him that he's not making any more?
I didn't believe him at first, but it's been a while, and so I think maybe he might be done.
Yeah. All right.
Have you ever corresponded with him, or have you ever written to him?
I've tried to.
Okay.
I've tried to. I've watched all of his films. One of his famous films, Satan Tango, is based on Krasznahorkai's novel of the same name.
Okay.
7 hours long.
Darn.
Yeah, and I was really obsessed, and so I've watched that film like almost 20 times, actually. And so my book, Damnation, which is my third book, is actually based on those films, and I draw out every shot of that film. And to be fair, for a 7-hour movie, there's actually not that many shots because it cuts so infrequently.
Right.
So I was trying to get that book into his hands, and I've been told that he has several copies of my book because many people that I know who know him, you know, gave him copies of my book, but for some reason I couldn't get him to respond to me. So
that's kind of frustrating.
You know, so I'd love to talk with him or, you know, see what he thinks or meet him. But he has my book, apparently, I've been told.
And then is there music in his films?
Yeah.
Is it atmospheric, kind of?
Or yeah, it's kind of instrumental, kind of emotional, classical type music. The composer for almost all of his films is Mihaly Vig. I don't know how you pronounce it. I'm not pronouncing it correctly. Or Vig Mihaly, depending on if it's Hungarian. I often listen to those soundtracks over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he actually starred in Satan Tango. He plays this false prophet. Yeah, so he also...
The composer starred in the film?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. So, I have a short attention span, kind of. To start a 7-hour film, you've seen it, what do? Do you just sit down and watch it? Do you have, like, water nearby?
Yeah, you have to be in a sort of certain emotional state.
Right.
Right? Like, I can't just watch it at any point in time, right? But when, like, during the peak of my obsession, I was also just really depressed. The kind of depressed where you're also, like, bored, right? You're not, like, necessarily... There's different types of depression, right? And this was one of those, like, really kind of bored over life kind of depressions. And there was this, like, this kind of not, you know, really strong apathy. The apathy was really consuming. And so the films actually... helped me bring me out of it. It's ironic. I mean, people have told me his films are quite bleak. They're not happy films, but the films are often about people who are a little bit terrible. They're not good people for the most part. They're just regular humans with flaws, but they are doing their best and they keep going. And there's something about that was actually very hopeful to me.
Mm-hmm.
I can totally relate. When I'm feeling down, I don't want to say depressed for me because that might be too big of a word, but when I'm feeling low, any kind of art that is reflective of that low feeling,
yeah,
it cheers me up because then I feel less alone.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't want it to be too sad, right?
Yeah,
like, I don't want to watch a film that's going to make me really emotional. And so I actually, for a while, I would purposefully avoid, like, friends would recommend me, like, oh, you'd love this film. And I knew I would love it. It was probably really great. I didn't want to watch it because I was so sensitive to things, right? So sometimes it's hard for me to watch something and feel something.
It's hard for you to watch and feel it because you feel like other people should have you feel a certain way about it?
No, just because I'm avoiding feeling more emotions than I'm already feeling.
Right. So what is it about Elliott Smith that makes me sadder than any other music? Why am I addicted to that sadness? Elliott Smith.
Yeah, I was listening to a lot of Elliott Smith when I wrote that. That was...
Right, just to be clear, Jeff's reading from
The Sky Isn't Blue.
From your book.
And then, Everything You Say Makes Me Want to Die, I Just Told the Biggest Lie, from Elliott Smith's song, The Biggest Lie.
Yeah, there's something about his songs that make me really sad, I think, partially of who he was, but there's something about, I think you can sense a lot of the sadness that he was going through mm-hmm. in his voice and his songs, right? Even when he's singing about things that don't, you know, the words don't necessarily seem to be corresponding to how he's feeling. And he's one of those singers for me where you can, especially now looking back and knowing what happened, you can sense all of that somehow in his voice. So it's really emotional for me to listen to him. I wrote The Sky Isn't Blue. I tell people I wrote it when I had writer's block, which is partially true because I couldn't write anything that I wanted to write. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, this is a pattern. I've been struggling with depression my whole life, right? So I was depressed, but it was like a very kind of weird, sensitive type of depressed. I had also gotten out of a long-term relationship. My mother had died. There were a lot of things going on. Mm. I was sort of on my own for the first time in my life. And so a lot of these things I would listen to or things I would see on TV, even if they weren't that important, would sort of pop up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was in a strange vampire state. Like, you know, in pop culture, like, vampires often, they describe them as, like, having heightened emotion.
Sure, sure.
Right? And so when they're sad, they're, like, really sad. And when they're happy, they're really happy. And that's why, like, you know, vampire sex is so great.
Right.
I sort of felt like that. Yeah.
And then this is all occurring in kind of L.A., right?
This was all in L.A. This was all in L.A.
I mean, and
currently I'm in Portland, and so...
you find the sun kind of oppressive? When I'm depressed and it's sunny out, I just hate it. I'm like, and then it's LA is the same.
I've always found the sun really oppressive, and I can understand like, you know, in Camus' The Stranger when uh-huh. he's just like, the sun made me do it. I mean, I get it.
Right.
I've always loved rainy weather and cloudy weather, so it was strange that I spent so much time, you know, basically living in the desert.
Right.
So Portland actually feels more like home to me. So, yeah, I feel like I'm where I'm supposed to be. I feel like I'm with the trees and rain and all of that.
So you graduate from UC San Diego, and you go right into MFA at CalArts.
Mm-hmm.
And then, how long ago was that?
We're doing a life history?
Yeah, we're going the whole thing.
How long ago was that? I finished my MFA in 2008.
So, and then you were there, you were in LA for another 9 years.
Because
then you moved here last year.
Yeah.
Okay. So you were in LA for a long time. Mm-hmm. You had to deal with the sun a lot.
Yes. Yes. And it kept getting worse, and it's still getting worse there.
Which neighborhood did you live in?
I lived all over. I lived in the Valley for a little bit. I lived in Silver Lake. And then when I moved, I was living in Altadena.
I lived in Los Feliz or Los Feliz, how mm-hmm. people say it down there. We're right next to the Silver Lake, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's been a while. That was the only part of the town that I thought was relatively livable because you could actually walk to things.
You could, but it's also not affordable anymore.
Now, yeah, I've heard that now yeah. it's way... LA is rough. I hated it.
Oh, yeah. It was... I mean, I have a love-hate relationship with that city, which... is detailed a lot in that book, The Sky Isn't Blue, right? Uh-huh. It's a beautiful city in a lot of ways, and it's a really toxic city in a lot of ways. And I mean toxic in every sense of the word, right? Literally as well.
Right.
And it wasn't until I got out that I realized how much it was affecting me, right? So I have friends there, and there's a lot of things I love, but it does something to you, right? People in that city are always aiming for something higher. Almost yeah. everyone I know there is not content. It doesn't matter whether they're already making a lot of money and they've technically achieved what they want or mm-hmm. they're working towards it. No one's content in that town. There's this ambition that kind of overrides everything. So people are working hard and it's unsustainable. And working multiple jobs in a place like LA, you have to drive in that traffic.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
It's not like New York where you can, you know, you can get on a train. It's a little bit, you know, there's a similar kind of tenor in New York, but there's something about that town that's a little bit more dense. And so it seems like you're kind of part of that with everyone, at least. And in LA, you're doing that, and so is everyone else, but you're doing it alone.
Well, you had a car the whole time, obviously, because you're driving.
Oh, yeah. But I could spend like 3 or 4 hours in a car in one day just going between jobs.
Ugh, that's wretched.
You know,
would you listen to? You listen to podcasts, music? What are you listening to?
All of the above. Yeah, I would listen to podcasts. Sometimes I listen to a lot of Radiolab. I would listen to music.
Okay.
Yeah. Sometimes I would just talk to myself.
Did you like LA? Or, I mean, did you like the MFA experience at CalArts and then you just stayed on? Or was it? Okay.
Yeah, because I had built a community there. So it made sense. And so I wanted to try and stay and find work.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when did you live in LA, Sonny?
Oh, boy. I have to think. This was, I think, Bush's first.
Bush the first or Bush the second?
Bush the second. I'm not that old.
Okay, I'm being insinuating.
How dare you? Yeah, it was something like... Oh, so, I was there when 9/11 happened.
So 2001.
Yeah, I moved there in 2001 and was there for 3 years.
Oh,
and
you were there a while.
And I lived downtown my first year when 9/11 happened, and everyone was going... like running out of that World Trade Center of downtown LA, and like I could look out the window of my apartment building and see them all like get out. That was weird.
I didn't know LA had a World Trade Center. Is that bad to say?
Portland has one.
Does it?
Yeah, there's little ones all over in coastal cities.
Oh.
But obviously not as famous.
I made a conversation mistake.
It's really dull. Do you know anything about World Trade Centers, Janice? No.
So then Nashville, how'd you get into that? Which seems somewhat atypical of your other,
I mean, maybe I often will binge on, you know, bad television. So I was like watching The Vampire Diaries really religiously for a long time. You know, these are like bad CW shows where it's like, they're like, you know, romantic and they're terrible. But like, once you get hooked, you just have to keep watching them, right?
What's CW?
CW, the TV network.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. I don't have a TV.
Yeah, they're like sort of famous for being really good at these types of shows where they're like good looking young people and they might be vampires or werewolves or in the apocalypse. The scenario changes, but
was Glee on the CW?
Glee was on Fox, I think.
Yeah, I think.
I don't know.
CW. I think Gilmore Girls started out in CW.
Yeah, but it wasn't CW back then. It changed. It used to be, I don't know. I don't remember. It was something before it was a CW. Like, The 100 is another show that's on the CW now. But anyway, so Nashville, I started watching it. I forget what drew me into it. I think because it was a musical show, and I've always kind of just been interested. So I watched it, and I was hooked. I love all the characters, and most of the music for that show is original. It was great, and for a long time, that's all I was listening to in the car. I was actually just listening to Nashville songs over and over again.
Was there a soundtrack, or you would just like loop them?
Yeah, there's a soundtrack. I mean, I just had my Spotify, and they would put up the songs every week, and
right.
Yeah.
I watched the first season of Nashville. It was on NBC, National Broadcast Corporation. But then it's okay. Go on. Sorry. So you got into it.
Yeah.
Okay. And then why'd you keep watching? Just because?
Yeah. I mean, once you're invested, you're invested, right? Uh-huh. But I love the music. I love the complexity of the characters. It has really good, interesting female characters. I think for a show like that, they're all really flawed, but also really strong. You know, even the characters that are really difficult. I think there's a lot of kind of redeeming qualities. So they're really complicated, and there is something that I kind of identified with in almost all of the characters, right?
Well, but it's like a soap opera, right?
It's like soap opera-ish, right? Uh-huh. Like, you know, there's relationships that form and end. But I think it's a lot smarter than most of those shows. I mean, there are a lot of things that I actually learned about relationships. There's like these strange little nuggets. Like, one of the characters will just say something.
And do you remember anything specifically that taught you about relationships?
Yeah, like I think there was like one like early on where there's like it's a new relationship that's starting, and the guy says something like, you know, you want to be in a relationship with someone who brings out the best in you and not the worst in you. And it's like a really simple thing, but I think at the time, whatever I was going through, I needed to hear that. And so the show is really good about those kinds of things where it's like common sense and it might be obvious, but it gives it to you in this way that, you know, you can see its whole context.
Sure. And then did you started watching that in L.A. and then you came, because it's just ended.
It just ended its final season.
And it switched. It went from NBC to
The Country Music Channel.
Yeah. And did you get that on your television?
Yeah, I watched it on Hulu.
Do you have your own Hulu?
No.
I use Meg Langford's. That's funny. I don't get it. Hulu. I don't have my own Hulu.
But what was the thing you said after that? Link words?
That's funny. You said no one has their own Hulu.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
You always use
someone has it, and then other people are using them.
Yeah, I understand now.
I think it's genius what they're doing, too, because eventually people are going to become so entrenched in using other people's Netflix and Hulu's that when they get kicked off, they're going to have to subscribe. Because they'll be like, I've been using Steve Woodward's Netflix for the last 5 years. And then you have to assume that they know what they're doing, right?
I do have my own Netflix.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. Oh, could I get your password when we're done? I'm just kidding.
I don't have any of those. I have HBO Now.
I just got a free month of that. I'm embarrassed.
I don't have a month. I have the whole thing. I just use somebody else's.
Oh, I'll be talking to you too afterwards.
So where were we? We were talking about Nashville. And were you bummed when it ended?
Oh, yeah. I know why it had to end, right? Like, shows end, and that's fine. I think it's better when shows end rather than drag on until people hate it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was sad. The last episode was really emotional.
Did you watch solo or with people?
I usually watched it by myself.
Okay.
Yeah, it was like the thing that I got to do by myself each week, you know, and I would like get to sit and watch this show for an hour. It's like a little bit cheesy, and it's got all the sentimental stuff. You know, I get to listen to the music and cry. It's cathartic, and then I go back to my regular life.
How often do you cry?
Oh, too often.
Really?
I'm jealous. Is it okay to be jealous of that?
I mean, I don't know. Maybe. I have a strange relationship with crying. I couldn't cry for a very long time. My parents were not terrible people, but they keep coming up as being terrible in these anecdotes. But because the childhood is different with parents than it is as adults, right?
Right.
But as a child, we had a very strict upbringing. And so we were not supposed to cry, even when we were being punished or disciplined and we were in trouble. Mm. We were told not to cry. It would make it worse, right? The punishment would get worse if we cried.
Explicitly, you were told that?
Yeah.
I mean, that wasn't just... Okay.
Oh, yeah.
That sounds so cruel to me.
I trained myself not to cry. And it was a way in order to avoid the consequences for both myself and my sister, who was younger and more sensitive to that, to the punishments that we were receiving. So I didn't cry for a very long time. And a lot of my undergrad in college, I cried very infrequently. And something happened. It was right about when I wrote The Sky Isn't Blue. It was that particular, depression that I was dealing with. After that, I would cry at literally everything, right? Mm-hmm. Happy, sad. I would just see like a squirrel outside on a tree. I would cry. I'd see something on TV or hear something on the radio. I was just crying all the time.
Did you feel sort of amazing just letting it out?
I mean, sometimes it feels good and sometimes it just like really interferes with what you're doing, you know?
You're in a job meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
But you'd gone through some type of transformation.
I guess so. Yeah.
And is that stayed on? I mean, do you still
Yeah, I mean, I have to sometimes kind of take care to not feel too much. I mean, I'm very empathetic, and so I feel a lot about what's going on around me as well. And I pass it on to my dog. So my dog actually also is often feeling like if I'm feeling sad, my dog is feeling sad. So I'm trying to not burden him with that.
How can you tell your dog is sad?
His whole like physical actions, like he's just like slumps over. I mean, he's
And near their own or their caretakers. What type of dog do you have?
I have two dogs. Benny and Maggie are their cockapoo mixes. I've had Benny for a long time, and he's like my animal soulmate, right? He's has like a very kind of traumatized past, and he's got a lot of issues, but the two of us really kind of understand each other, I think, implicitly. And then Maggie's a little bit younger. She's like, you know, in some ways more of a normal dog, and in other ways I think she's actually a cat.
Oh. So are these big dogs or small?
No, they're small. Maggie's like a 14-pound dog, and Benny's about 30 pounds. So he's like a medium dog.
Okay. And you've had them for years?
I've had them both for many years, yeah.
Yeah. I have a dog. It's named Beckett Long Snout. Yeah, what are your snouts of your dogs? Are they short or long?
I think they're like medium length, but they're covered with a beard.
Oh.
You know? They've got really nice bushy beards.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to Google these. I have no idea what they look like.
Yeah, I'll show you some pictures of my dog.
Say it again, though.
Cockapoo. So they're like part Cocker Spaniel, part Poodle. Oh. But I think they're actually more mutt than that, but that's like the breed that's written on their certificate, right? Uh-huh.
And you got them in L.A.?
I got them both in L.A. Yeah.
My dog, he's named after Samuel Beckett, who's my favorite author, and he's been... Well, you say that they kind of... I mean, it's implicit, your soulmate, or what did you say?
Yeah, I mean, I love them both, but, you know, Maggie's not, like, my best friend, right? Yeah. Like, I love her, but she won't sit next to me. Like, if I'm, like, crying, you know, Maggie's just like, oh, whatever, I'm just gonna go sit by the window and do my own thing. And Benny is, like, there with his paw on my leg and, like, very concerned.
Right, yeah.
You know, and so it's obvious how they treat, you know.
Extremely in tune. I mean, yeah, because I don't even have to say anything, and sometimes I don't even notice. But when I'm tense or when I'm aggravated, Beckett will come over and he has the long snout, so he'll snout, you know, stick his snout up, and then he'll wag his tail. I mean, but sometimes I don't realize that I'm aggravated. It's great. Well, I don't know if it's great, but it's shows.
But
you
they
know.
Sometimes know what you need before you do.
Right. Exactly. That's a far more succinct and better way of putting it.
I'm so not a dog person, but listening to the two of you, Sunny. It's
are you an animal person or a cat person or maybe a plant person?
I love I'm definitely an animal person, but and a cat is the only thing I tend to have in my house.
Sarah the cat. I had Sarah the cat. Sarah was nice. I don't know about your cats, but
my cat is he's great. Pim?
Like the champagne.
You're so is there a champagne named Pim?
Probably.
Well, it's not named after that. Pim was almost what we named our son.
Oh.
Which is a normal name in the Netherlands where he was born, but we thought, we had a feeling we were moving back here, and we thought that name might be tough for a boy to grow up with in America. So we gave it to the cat.
It's a good cat name.
Yeah.
I respect that. I respect you.
Yes. Yes.
Janice, I want to end on two things. So this is from a later part of The Skies in Blue. The moon is hiding from me, and then something as silly as Linkin Park's In the End playing on the radio to springboard you into an urgent and devastating nostalgia. And then space, is this living? Linkin Park.
Yeah, I listened to a lot of Linkin Park. I was like a freshman, I think, in college when at the peak of Linkin Park.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I don't know. It was like, I mean, it was really popular and there's, you know, all of that. But I think at the time there was like, it was like that right mix of like anger and, but like the rock feel, you know? And so there was something about it that like felt really right. So I always associate that with being younger.
Right. And then, but you don't listen to, like, if that came on the radio, you'd be nostalgic for it, but it wouldn't be like,
yeah,
I want to go back to that.
I wouldn't, like, necessarily switch the radio. I'd probably, like, leave it on. You know, but I've often, you know, one of my best friends, Michael Seidlinger, he's a big, he listens to a lot of metal and, like, but Linkin Park is one of those things we're often both nostalgic about. So if we're in the car, he's in New York, so we're rarely in the car together, but if we're in the car together, that's often the thing that we'll play and
you'll play Linkin Park,
sing,
really?
Oh yeah, we'll like sing at the top of our lungs. In the End, yeah.
Is In the End on the Tony Hawk Pro Skateboarder soundtrack?
I would not know, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay, and then I think of Wilco's song Jesus Etc., which Eileen Miles in a poetry workshop I use an example of the quality of the sestina. And then it goes on. What was the story with that?
Yeah, this is good. You pulled out like almost every musical reference in my book.
I did some research.
Yeah, that song by Wilco has this quality where the chorus keeps repeating, but it morphs a little bit. It's not the exact same chorus. I can't remember exactly now, but small words will change. Eileen Miles actually played it when she was doing a poetic form, and I thought it was interesting to kind of talk about how, you know, poetic forms are often so fixed, right? Like a sonnet or a sestina, there's like a very particular formula and there's reasons for that. But also part of what's successful about something like a sestina is that it's the feeling that the repetition gives you, right? So the sestina, for people who don't know, it's like you have the same end words, but there's this formula where it you switch the order, right? So in each stanza, those same end words are used, but in a different order. So for me, reading a sestina or hearing one, it feels like deja vu because you can't necessarily predict what's going to happen unless you're like a sestina expert, right? But like for your average person, yeah. You don't really know what the word is going to come. But it keeps repeating and you hear it and it changes the feeling of that repetition so that every repetition is a little bit different. And so that Wilco song is kind of similar where you hear a song and you often expect to hear the chorus. I mean, choruses often change, but in that song in particular, the shifts are so subtle and so it has that kind of strange feeling of uncanniness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In a good way, in a way that surprises people.
Exactly.
And that's what you want,
exactly.
Essentially.
There's a little bit of a familiarity mm-hmm. in knowing that it's being repeated, but because you can't quite predict it or put your finger on it, it feels a little bit strange, too.
Sure. You get both the inside and the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Sonny, have you ever heard that song?
I don't think so. I don't know. I'd have to hear it.
Okay. I guess we'll just end. What are you reading or listening or doing now with your life?
What am I...
Or watching or anything.
Can you make it
that's
more
like,
broad?
That's like the hardest question that you ask anyone. You're like, what are you into right now? And like suddenly your mind goes
blank.
Well,
you're getting ready to teach. Yeah, this won't come out for a little bit, but you'll be in the midst of a successful quarter. And by the time this comes out. And then television or film or anything that new you're watching or...
Well, I recently just watched Crazy Rich Asians and I loved it.
It was good.
It was very good.
I was trying to take my kid to that and he always wants to see the trailer first, but he was like, way too much kissing. No way. No, no, no.
Too much kissing. It's really funny.
He's a typical boy.
Yeah. I just recently rewatched The Big Sleep.
Mm.
I've been rewatching a lot of Humphrey Bogart films.
The Maltese Falcon?
Yeah, The Big Sleep, The Maltese Falcon, and Casablanca.
Legit.
Just rewatched. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I think we're good. You feel good?
I enjoyed hearing the two of you talk about dogs. And I want to say, because I've been pretty anti-dog for a long time. And I often get flack from that. Like, people are like, you don't like dogs. And they really give me a bad look. But hearing the two of you talk about them, I could finally see, the niceness of it.
Dogs are amazing.
Well, they're so unique because they're the only part of nature. Like, if you think of all animals and plants, what I love about all animals and all plants is they don't come to you. And you're just lucky if you get to see them or somehow be a part of it. But dogs are the one thing. They always come to you, and they often want something. Like, they want you to touch their head.
They're one of the few animals that have co-evolved with humans.
Mm. Right, which is sort of our fault.
Yeah, and I mean, it is. But now that's happened already, right? And so they're dependent on us, and we're dependent on them. And so they actually do know us mm-hmm. really well.
Yeah. So I guess I just wanted to say thank you guys for letting... I'm still not going to ever have a dog, but it was nice to see it a little bit briefly.
Glad to open your minds.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you so much, Janice.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And... You're listening to The Steer, recorded at KBOO Radio, broadcast on dublab.com. Hosted by Jeff Alessandrelli and Sonny Bleckinger. For more, see our website at www.the-steer.com. You can download our episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, and anywhere podcasts are found.